So for the max cut problem,
we were given basically a graph, and we wanted to find the largest cut that we could within a minute, solving it exactly within a minute. And we were given, I gave you different test files. Five people submitted their programs to me, okay? And I know them by their email addresses. One person submitted a program that was too complicated for me to run, but that person didn't get run, okay? Another person's program gave me the wrong answer on 20 vertices, okay? So they gave me a max cut of 50, where there was a max cut of 51. So they were pruning, they were very fast, but they were too fast for their own good. So that person eliminated. We now have three of them left. All of them could then do the instance on 25 vertices within a minute, okay? And that then the third program, okay, by a student named Inho, whose email is Inho, ran out of gas on 30, okay? So but the other two could do 30 vertices within a minute. But at 35 minutes, at 35 vertices, the two remaining programs were J.P. Walker's and Lily Z. Cow's. And Lily Z. Cow's could do it within 22 seconds, whereas the other program went into Never Never Land. Okay, couldn't do it within a minute. So the winner was Lily Z. Cow with 35 vertices. See here? Or?
Okay. You here? Okay, come on up. Round of applause for our winner. Come on up for a second. Okay. So, first of all, tell me, what was your algorithm for doing the search? Tell me about your program.
Yeah, first, I just think about the set. When you do a set, for example, the 1, 2, 3 is the same as 3, 2, 1. So, I put in the head.
So, you took the asymmetry.
Yeah.
That somehow that you knew that every set, you might as well talk about the set that had the first item in it. Okay, so that we agree, cut the search space by a half. What else did you do?
Then I just make a shortcut and find the maximum degree of the vertices.
Okay, what do you do with the maximum degree of the vertices?
I just make the best approximation, find the
No worry about it. This is okay. So how did your search proceed? You're telling me that you started by building up the subset that you used the backtracking procedure we used in class, or not quite?
I just made a change.
Okay, what did you change?
The something like the book chapter.
Okay.
It's a find the subset.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I used that.
And how did you prune it? So now, how did you decide when you didn't have to look at a subset after a while? Did you build all subsets completely and then compute the max cut of them?
No. I just said first break is 2 of the subset. And when we reach the fourth, I just cut
everything. Okay. So did you do any pruning based on the size of the solution you already had?
Yeah.
So what was that? How did you prune it based on? Did you search all, build all subsets, or how did you? When did you decide to stop the pruning? To prune it?
Yes, this is the same. When we stop here, we got all the truths here. The same thing as we from here, we got all the faults here.
I see.
Yeah, it's the
Okay.
After,
right.
After
that's how you cut the search by half.
Yes.
Okay, that's not what I'm interested in now. What I'm interested in, how did you decide when a partial solution wasn't going to lead to anything better? Did you do any other pruning?
Yeah, I did.
How was that working?
All the verses and
then... Okay, go.
We have three sets.
Right. I see. So these are the ones that are on the left, these are the ones that are on the right, these are the ones that are unselected.
Yeah, unselected.
Okay, right.
If we select all the verses in the selected set, we don't need to if you want to select the region, one charge from here and one charge from here. If we got the degree, the degree the virtues come here to last the fifth year, and we don't need to look at the subject.
Okay. But wait, okay, so there are a couple of different things you might be saying as far as optimizations. So one thing that is true is the following, that I think you may have just been saying, I'm not sure. These are the ones that we put in the left side. These are the ones we put on the right side. Any vertex here that now is only adjacent to things on the left or on the right, you can put that there without any further thinking. Is that what you did? Certainly that's a true optimization. Does everybody see this? Let's say you have a partial solution built up of some of the vertices are on the left, some are on the right. Now, of the remaining edges in the vertices in the graph, if all the edges from this vertex are the things on the left, then without loss of generality, you can put it on the right and you can't go wrong. Does everybody agree with that? So you don't have to actually try this vertex on both sides. Is that something you did or not really?
Yeah, I also did one thing. Just to if I select the edges from left and the degree from left, it's important that I want to select the edges from the right. I don't need to think about it.
Okay, so what you're saying is that if the number of edges that are left in this set, okay, so what I think what you're saying is that somehow the number of edges here that potentially can get cut is less than the sum of this plus the number of edges so far is less than the best solution you so far have. You don't have to look at this subset, look at any subsets of this. Is that what you were saying? Does everybody agree with that? That's certainly true. Okay? And that is an optimization I think most people probably saw. That's an important pruning thing. That if you had a solution with 50 edges cut, you have a partial solution such that this thing cuts 20 edges, and this thing only has 25 edges within it, there is no way that we can get a bigger cut by moving this around, right? So we could cut now. Okay, any other pruning optimizations that you did, or that's all? Okay, very good. Okay, thank you. Here's your prize. It's a copy of my other book, okay, on gambling. Okay, so here, thank you. Good, okay. And for all of you, it's available from Cambridge University Press. It's a nice book. So what were the other optimizations that we could have done? One interesting trick that I liked from this is the idea that once you add vertices here, where every edge has already been assigned to these guys here, without loss of generality, you can figure out where it goes. Okay? And that avoids trying both possibilities. Does everybody understand that as a pruning thing? Okay? One other idea, which I didn't see people use, but which I think is kind of an interesting thing, is the way that she was determining her cutoffs, or at least it sounded like to me, she was cutting off her search the moment the size of what she had so far definitely cut, and the number of edges remaining was less than the best that she had done so far. Is there any stronger condition under which we could prune? Okay? What about the following idea? Suppose, let's say, I have a vertex here that's of degree 10. Four of which go to the vertices on the left, four of which go to vertices on the right, and two of which go to other vertices which are not yet placed. What is the maximum number of edges that we can cut with this vertex? Is it 10? It's 6. Does everybody see that it's not in, that
sure we can, you know, we could use as a upper bound on the potential for the vertex the number of edges that remain. But in fact, if it's got some vertices that go to the left and some vertices that go to the right, and some vertices that are unassigned, there is no way you can cut all those edges, right? Even though we haven't placed this vertex. Does everybody sort of see what I mean? Or are people confused or baffled or any questions? I would claim that an upper bound for what I could get from this is that basically the cut size from between the left and right vertices I've already placed, plus over all unplaced vertices, I can get the most I can hope to cut is the max of the numbers, vertices on the left or right, plus the number of unplaced elements of that vertex. Okay, so this notation may not be very clear, but let's look at it. Okay? So the lower bound that I can get for every vertex I haven't placed, the most I can still hope to cut is the larger of the number of edges that go to the left or right, plus the number of unplaced edges that go to unplaced vertices. And when I sum that thing up, I'm going to get a lower upper bound than if I just summed up the edges, the degrees of these vertices. Okay? And that's where I can hope to win. Any questions? Did anybody use this particular upper cutoff strategy? Okay? How many people use something where they did it basically, where they did their cutoff as she did, based on the sum of the cut we have so far, plus the sum of the edges that are not yet cut? Okay, how many people pruned on the basis of that? I see at least one other person. Any other pruning that people did that they were proud of or not proud of? Or at least a bit to. Any questions? Okay. Well, that would get you to about 35 vertices. I confess I didn't implement it, but I bet you this would probably get you to 40, 45 vertices, somewhere in there. Okay, because you would get, I suspect, a much quicker lower bound. Your upper bound of what you can hope to gain is going to be a lot smaller. Okay? Any questions? And I like the idea that she had, which I hadn't thought about before, that once I have established that a vertex has a degree of zero on one side, I might as well move it to the other side. Okay? Any questions? Okay, very good. Any other questions or issues about the contest? Okay, so good luck with that. The only other thing that I would like, the other thing that I would like to talk about today, just to sort of, is to talk a little bit about shortest paths, weighted shortest paths. We talked about that a little bit last class. This is Dijkstra's algorithm. We talked about, in some detail, you saw the idea of Prim's algorithm for minimum spanning trees. You heard Levon talk about it, and you heard me talk about it. And at the end of last class, I showed you that the difference in code between Dijkstra's algorithm for finding the shortest weighted path between vertices was almost exactly the same as Prim's algorithm for minimum spanning trees. It differed in exactly two lines when you implement it. Okay? What is the idea? Well, Dijkstra's shortest path algorithm uses the following idea. Okay? Basically, that if we have the shortest path from S to T goes through X, then darn it, we better find the shortest path from S to X. Does everybody agree with that? That if I told you that the shortest path between here and New Jersey went through Staten Island, then you have to implicitly find the shortest path from here to Staten Island in order to get to Jersey. Does everybody agree with that? That's got to be obvious. Okay? So really what Dijkstra's algorithm does to try to find the shortest path between vertices S and T is compute the shortest path from vertex S to every other vertex. Okay? Building basically a what we will call a shortest path spanning tree, where you start from one vertex, okay, your source, and constantly see what is the next vertex that you can reach with the lowest total cost. Okay? Because that, I claim, we will find the shortest, you know, we will know the shortest path from S to that. And if in each generation we can gain the shortest path from S, our source, to another vertex, after n iterations, we will have the shortest path to every vertex, and thus implicitly the one that you want. Any questions? Let's look at an example.
Okay, I mean, this is a example I have from someplace. Let's take a look at this.
So here's a graph where we should be able to see the weights. Let's say we want to find the shortest path from A to everybody else. What is the shortest path, the distance from A to itself? Zero. Is it clear that in every graph, the shortest path from a vertex to itself is zero? The answer is not quite. Okay, under what condition might the shortest path from a vertex to itself not be zero? If you had negative weight edges. Let's say I wanted to find the cheapest way to get from here, in dollar set terms, from here to New Jersey. You know, it costs a certain amount of money to pay tolls, and it costs a certain amount to drive a distance on a road, either pay for gas. But suppose there was this bank in Hicksville that every time you drove through it would give you $10. Okay? What would be the cheapest way to get from here to New Jersey? The answer is you drive to Hicksville. It may cost you $20 to get to Hicksville. Then keep circling the bank over and over and over again, having them give you more and more money, and never actually get to Jersey. Does everybody agree with that? Okay? So negative weight edges will mess up the shortest path problem, right? Does everybody agree with that? Now, you may say, well, that's not how banks behave, okay? And there are certain applications where graphs with negative weight edges are interesting. Okay, they're relatively esoteric, right? but there are real applications where that comes up. Okay, but for now, let's assume in the rest of our discussion of shortest paths, we do not have negative weight edges. Does everybody agree that negative weight edges will mess up shortest paths? And certainly, if you have a cycle of negative weights, so you can go to one place -1, -1, -1, -1. It will mess you up to the point that you will never leave. Okay? You can get to your destination for as low a cost as you want. Okay? So negative cost cycles really mess you up. Negative weight edges mess you up in that you can no longer guarantee that the cheapest way for a vertex to it, you know, basically to itself, or it messes you up in lots of ways. So we're not going to allow negative weight edges. Does everybody agree with that? Okay, good. But let's say we do allow negative weight edges. If we're at vertex A, we know we can get there at a cost of zero. What other vertex do we know the cheapest way to get to, just by looking at the neighborhood of A? B. We can get to B at a cost of 2. Is it obvious that there is no other way to get to B for less than 2? Why do we know this? Because we know we can get to F at a cost of greater than or equal to 9, right? I mean, we know we can get to F at a cost of less than or equal to 9. Okay, well, it's less than or equal to 9. We don't know that it's greater than or equal to 9, do we? We do know that to get off from here to here, we can get to G at a cost of less than or equal to 5. Does everybody agree with that? And we know that we can get out of here at a cost of less than or equal to 2. But what do we actually know? That to get from S to anywhere else, okay, I claim that the minimum weight of those edges describes the cheapest way to get out of A. Does everybody agree with that? So we can make the argument that, look, to get from here to here, to get out of any edge, to cross this sink, any way we cross it, we're going to have to pay at least the cost of 2. Okay, does everybody agree with that? And so therefore, we know that the cost to get the vertex B is at least 2, is exactly 2. Does everybody agree with that? Fine. What do we now know? What can we now update? Now that we know the cheapest way to get to 2, what consequences does that have for other vertices? What do we now know? Can we go through 2 to get to any other vertex? How do we do that? Where else can we get to from 2? From this, from B? G. What's the cost of getting to G through 2? 8, because it's 2 plus 6, right? It's the cost of getting to that vertex plus the outgoing edge, right? Does that improve our state of knowledge about G? No, we already know a way to get there to 5. Okay? So it's uninteresting that we can get there at a cost of 8. Is it interesting that we can get to here at a cost of 6? Well, potentially. Certainly we now know it's less than or equal to 6 to get to C. Does everybody agree with that? Now what do we know? We've evaluated all the consequences of getting out of here. What is the cheapest way we can now get out of here to something else? To G. I claim that there is no other way to get out of here any cheaper than it is to get to G. Right? That's basically what we've proven. We've evaluated all possible direct routes out of this area that we know the best way to get to. The best way to get to some other vertex is going to have to be through the best way that we have gotten to one of the vertices we know the best way to. So what does that now tell us? The optimal way to get to here is 5. And now at a cost of 5, we can get there. What are the consequences of now having reached 5? G. How far, what's the cost of getting to I? Less than or equal to 7. Less than or equal to 10. Now, doesn't this look a little bit like Prim's algorithm? Does it look a lot like Prim's algorithm? Okay, we're starting with a group of vertices we know the cheapest way to link it in. And one by each iteration, we're sucking up another vertex that is a neighbor of this. The cheapest way to add somebody else to the club. Any questions? So which is the next guy who gets sucked up? Which vertex? C. We can get to C at a cost of less than or equal to 6, right? So now we know that C can be reached at a distance of 6. So maybe I'll take it in a circle. What is the consequence of getting to 6? Of getting to C, what do we now learn from C? That if we're going to reach some vertex directly through C, what vertices can we reach directly through C? H, what's the cost of getting to H? Is that interesting? Can we get to here at a cost of what? 8. Is that interesting? Well, maybe. So far it is. What's the next vertex we want to suck up? Okay, I. That's the cheapest one we know how to get to. So now this is going to be reachable at a cost of 7. What are the consequences of that? What's the cost now of getting up to F? 8, right? We now have a way to get there at a cost of 8. Can we get to E? What's the cost of that? Less than or equal to 10. Can we get to H at what cost? 11. Is that interesting? No, it's not interesting. What's the next vertex we can suck up now? F or D? It doesn't matter which one, right? Because they're both going to be reached in H. There's nobody else who could be reached in less than H, right? So why don't I think, which one do you want me to grab first? F? Okay, so we'll grab F. This is now exactly 8. Oh, okay, so you're right. So we have to keep track of who is the guy that's going to let us in there, right? Didn't we have to do that in Prims too? Basically it's the same strategy as Prims, right? So yeah, so that's how we got in there. What's the consequences of getting to here? Does this give us a new way to get to E? Well, it does, but not a cheap way to get to E. Okay, only if the road's very backed up when we think about that. That's 14, so that's not good. What's the next vertex we're going to grab? A. Now from here, how fast can we get to, is this an interesting vertex? Yes, because this now lets us get to H at a cost of 9. And this lets us get to E at a cost of 9. What's left to do? We might as well grab this one. The outgoing edges are to vertices we already know the best way to, so that's not going to be very interesting. And then finally, we're going to go and add this guy to the list. Does everybody agree that this now gives us the shortest path spanning tree? Okay, and this now tells us the shortest path from O, A, to everybody else. Okay? Any questions? So what is the time of this algorithm? Let's think about it. Okay? By comparing our implementation of Prims to this thing. Okay? What's the time complexity of this strategy? How many iterations are we going to be doing? We have n vertices and m edges. How many iterations? Each iteration is going to be gobbling up another vertex, right? How many vertices can we gobble? N. So the time is going to be n times the cost to process a vertex, right? How much time does it take to process a vertex? What are we doing once we have decided to gobble up this vertex? What work do we do? How much does it cost us? So then what are we actually doing? You're going to look at which vertices you're going to look at. Of all the ones that haven't been, the first thing you're going to do is look at all the outgoing edges of that vertex, right? What? So it's the degree, it's the out degree of that vertex, right? That will tell us, now that we know the exact shortest path to this guy, that will now tell us, we now look at the outgoing edges there, and that will tell us how much to update everybody else. That will take time proportional to the degree of the vertex. What is the maximum degree of a vertex? N. So if you want to just use the big picture, that would be N. What else do we have to do? Is it enough just to look at the outgoing edges of a vertex?
We still have to search for the guy who has the smallest bound so far, right? So that means we're going to have to scan through all the vertices in the graph. Which is the vertex that we're interested in? What is the criteria that we want to use to select the next vertex to include? Smallest value? What was that? Smallest cost on, okay. What is the next vertex we're adding to the shortest path spanning tree? Okay. It's not the one with the smallest value, because zero is going to have the, A is going to have the smallest value. Right? Smallest value not yet added, right? So how can we select that within in order and time? Is there a natural data structure that we can use to store this? What do we have to store for every vertex? The cost of getting through it so far. And anything else? Whether it's already added or not, right? That can be done by a Boolean, true, false, right? Are you in the tree or not? Okay, the other is an integer. And so it's basically now sweeping through all the vertices. Are you in? If so, let me, I want you. Okay. If you're in and you're lower than I have so far, I want you. Any questions? Yes? Then you also have to store what its parent is if you want to reconstruct what the shortest path to a vertex is, right? You really want to know how far away it is. You really want to say Jersey's 30 miles away, forget it. I don't want to go to Jersey. You don't need the parents, okay? But on the other hand, if you want to reconstruct the path, you need to know who is the guy who got credit for bringing me into the tree. Any questions? So what is the result? Let's look at my program for Dijkstra's algorithm. This is my entire program, and you've almost seen it before. You've seen it before, except basically up to and including, oh sorry, I guess you can't read it like that. You've seen it because it looks very much like Dijkstra's algorithm, like Flynn's algorithm. What are we doing? For every vertex, we have a flag. Is it in the tree? What is the distance to it? And who is its parent? Originally, a parent. Nobody has a parent. Nobody is in the tree. And everybody is infinitely far away from the root, right? Then we finally say the start vertex is a distance zero. And V is the vertex on the, that's the starting vertex. Was that the current vertex that we're working with to V? So what's this saying? While V is not in the tree yet, okay, then we have to now add this vertex to the tree. So now it gets set to be in the tree. We now look at what's the consequences of putting it in the tree. For every edge going out of that vertex V, for I goes to the degree of the vertex, for each outgoing edge, VW. If the distance to vertex W that we currently have is bigger than the distance to V plus the distance of the weight of the edge, VW, we have now discovered a cheaper way to get to W, right? That's what that's saying here. Okay? If the distance to W that we know about is bigger than the distance to V, which we know is the shortest way to get to V, plus the edge from V to W, we discovered a better way to get to W. So what do we know? The distance to W is this distance now, and the parent of W is at least tentatively set to V. Any questions about that? That should make sense. That's exactly what we've been doing. Any questions? So now we've updated it in the tree. How do we find the next vertex in the tree? Well, for every vertex V equals 1, the best distance we have to a vertex not in the tree is maxence. For all the other vertices, if the vertex is not in the tree and the distance
to the shortest distance, the shortest non-free vertex, closest non-free vertex I know about. If that's bigger than the distance of I, then we've discovered a new closest non-free vertex. And that's going to be named I. Any questions? So V is now the name of the vertex that is the closest one. Next time through the loop, we're going to go process that. Any questions? So this is obviously an n-squared algorithm. Why? Well, I mean, this outer loop can only go around, every vertex can only be set once to be true or false, so there's going to be at least n, you know, it's at most n times we can go through it, because it's at most n times that we're setting vertices through. This is taking time proportional to the degree of the vertex, this is taking time proportional to the number of vertices. N times n is n squared. Any questions? And that's how you find shortest paths in non-negative weights, but weighted graphs. Any questions? Okay. Any questions about Dijkstra's algorithm for shortest paths? Okay. So now you know how to compute shortest paths in unweighted graphs and in reasonable weighted graphs. Any questions? What I'd like to do is just show you an application of shortest paths. So it turns out that finding shortest paths in graphs is a very useful thing to do. Okay, so a lot of, let's say, real-life problems, applications, if you wish, turn out to really look like shortest path problems. Even if they're not networked, they'll don't look like anything to do with roads or something like that. And I'd like to talk about one problem that I worked on. It's described as a war story in the book, where we use shortest paths in a non-trivial way, in a non-obvious way, as a shortest path kind of a problem. And this had to do, we were building a system to recognize text that was entered on a telephone. Okay, so what happens, you know you have a telephone, you know you've got the numbers 0 through 9, and the letters have 8, you know, there's 3 letters written on every digit in a telephone, right? I guess the key 2 is written, has ABC written on it. Is that right? Anybody with a cell phone will agree? Okay. And if you notice, there are keys 2 through 9 all have 3 letters on it, right? So 2 through 9 is 8, okay? 8 times 3 is 24. There's room for all the letters of the alphabet, right or wrong? Wrong. So what 2 letters are not on your telephone? Have you ever thought about that? Okay, it's 2 letters that are not on your cell phone. Which ones are they? Probably Q and Z. Okay, something to check later. Don't look down. Don't reach for your phone. I think Q and Z are what it is. Okay? But suppose you wanted to type on a cell phone. And I guess now people do that kind of thing, right? You guys want to send messages to each other during the exam or something like that. You know, you sit there and you type on your... That's why cell phone's not allowed on the exam. Okay? But the problem is, to enter text, you have to hit more than one key to recognize a letter, right? Isn't that true? Okay? Why is that? Because you've got 3 choices for every button. So either you've got to add more information than just one key press, or the computer has to try to guess what you're typing, which one of the 3 letters you meant to type. Does everybody agree with that? So we once built a system to try to guess which one of the 3 letters you meant to type. Okay? And how did this work? Well, what we did was, again, the interesting part of the notion was, we said that when you were hitting an end of a word, we said you'd hit a star button. Okay? So you type a word, and you hit a star button. And if you had a Q or a Z, you'd also hit a star button, but nobody's going to hit the Q or Z very often, so let's not worry about that. Okay? But what we did was, we had a dictionary of all words that were known. Okay? And when you would type in a string of words, symbols, 4, 4, 8, 3, we would look at our dictionary to see which words matched that, which words were hashed to that. And in this case, give and hide both match to that. Okay? If we look at 6, 2, 3, of and me both
match to that. Okay? The oven and me are both 6'3 on your telephone. R turns out to be the eighth and the only word made out of two. But there's four words, ring, ping, and sing, that 7, 4, 6, 4 match to. So if you wanted to try to figure out which sentence you meant, it probably is either give or hive, followed by of or me, followed by followed by either ping, ring, or sing. Okay? So how many different sentences might there be for this particular input? I claim 2 times 2 times 3. That's what? That's 12 different sentences that you could make from these words, right? Does everybody agree with that? Well, which one is the one that's likely right? Probably give me a ring. Okay? But how could you figure out that one sentence was better than another? Okay, any ideas here? Let's think of, see what the problem is. I now know what words are possible for each slot. How do I make the most reasonable sounding sentence? Any ideas? Yeah? Need to know something about the grammatical structure of a language. So what does that mean actually? So for example, a good example of this might be the word that collides the most, just so you know, is box, boy, any, cow. There's like 11 words that will collide from those same set of symbols on the telephone. And one idea is to note that you're right, that some of these are different parts of speech than others. Okay? So one thing that we did was, by analyzing a lot of text, we figured out how often nouns like to be next to verbs, and how often adjectives like to be next to nouns. Okay? So if we look at this thing, and then this one's probably a little bit hard to tell, because I guess of and me are different parts of speech, right? So let's see, give me a, give of a, doesn't quite sound right. Has anyone ever heard, does the word give of appear in words fairly, in text fairly often? I don't think it does. But give me occurs more often than give of. So one thing that you could do is to build a graph where there is an edge between every pair of adjacent words. And the weight of that edge is going to be proportional to how happy we are to have those words next to each other. Part of that can be based on grammar, okay?